I can tell you this, I called my mother, as a good son tries to do from time to time. I called my mother in Canada, and of course one of my normal, natural questions to her is, "Mom, have you been going to church?" Of course, this is one of my great concerns, and she said, "Oh yes, yes, we had the best church service last Sunday, Bryn." And I said, "Oh yeah, what was so great about it?" She said, "Well, it was a lessons and carol service, and so the sermon was very short." And it made for an outstanding service of worship. Well, in case you're wondering, I once preached a 12-minute sermon at my church in Toronto. A 12-minute sermon, and I was told by one of the members of the church afterwards that it was my best sermon ever. Now, I'm absolutely certain it was not my best sermon ever, but the compliment really was code for, "I really like when your sermons are short, and if you keep it that way, I will say nice things to you after service." Well, there I go. I've already eaten into my 12 minutes, and I'll do my best, but I'm not sure. No promises. The change of course happened when I was driving my 10-year-old daughter, Anya, home from school the other day. And I said to her, "Anya, I think most of your friends know that your father is a pastor. And so it might come about, if not this year, in some future date, someone will ask you, what is the meaning of Christmas? Or they might ask you more specifically, for what reason did Jesus come? What did Jesus come to do?" And Anya struggled at first to find an answer. You could see the wheels were turning, and I could sense that she had a lot of information, but she was struggling to connect the dots for me. And finally she said, "Well, Jesus came to save us from our sins." And that's a good answer. That's a biblical answer. But I thought about how long it took her. I thought about how it didn't come naturally. I thought about how she struggled to give precision to an answer to a very important question. And so it occurred to me that there might be more than a few of us who would struggle to concisely summarize an answer to the question, what did Jesus come to do? What did Jesus come to do? Well, part of our struggle in answering this question with any precision has to do with the fact that Jesus came to do many things, didn't he? He came to do many things. You even hear Jesus speak in these terms. Jesus says, "I came not to do this, but rather I came to do that. I came not to heal the healthy, but rather I came to heal the sick." He said, "I came not to be served, but I came rather to serve, and so on. But as we sift through all of the things Jesus came to do, and all of the things he did do, are we able to detect some primary things? Are we able to focus the lens, as it were, on the main objectives of Jesus' life? I would answer that we can. And I'm going to attempt to answer that in part by using an analogy. For every human being who has ever lived, there is a standard set before us which we must meet. There is a bar set above us that we must reach. There is a test, if you will, that we must pass. And the bad news is that before Jesus' advent, the flunk rate to this test was 100%. Nobody was meeting the standard. No one was passing the test. Now, some of you are undoubtedly scrolling in your mind through some of the Old Testament stories. What about Abraham? Didn't he pass the test? What about Joseph? Didn't he meet the standard? What about Moses? What about Ruth? What about Daniel? And so on. We imagine that many people, past and present day, have met the standard and passed the test because, quite frankly, we have misunderstood the standard. We have misunderstood or not yet understood the standard that God has set before us. Many imagine that the standard before us is like a ledger. On the one side of the ledger are all the things we've done in our life that God approves of. And on the other side of the ledger are all the things we've done in our life that God does not approve of. And so our aim then is to have the number of positive things we've done outnumber the negative things we have done. And we imagine that so long as the positive outnumbers the negative, then everything will be okay. As long as the score is 51% or above, we imagine that we have passed the test and that we will get into heaven. Unfortunately for us, the Bible gives a different standard for us to reach. In the Old Testament and the New Testament, God is described as being holy. He's described as being perfect. He's described as being pure. And the corresponding imperative is for you and me to be holy. Jesus says, "Be holy as I am holy." That's the biblical standard. James in his epistle writes, "Whoever keeps the whole law and yet stumbles at just one point is guilty of breaking all of it." In other words, the mark to which we must reach is not 51%, but 100%. 100% is the score that we need to get into heaven. Accordingly, Paul tells the Romans that no one will ever be justified by observing the law. No one will ever be justified by observing the law. And this is because, as Paul says in Romans 3:23, all have sinned and all fall short of the glory of God. To put it another way, no one is scoring 100%. If I ask for a show of hands, who thinks we're at 100% this morning? I would doubt very severely that any of us would dare raise our hand. We know, I think instinctively, that none of us will score 100%. And this is why I think we came up with a ledger system. Because we knew that we couldn't get 100, so we thought, well, I think I can get 51% or higher. I think I can have the number of good things outweigh the bad things. But that's not the standard. The standard that God gives us cannot be met by us. The test that's before us is not a test that we can pass. It's not a test that any human outside of Christ has passed. And the penalty, we're told, for failing the test is ultimately death. The penalty, we are told, for not passing the test is to face the judgment of a God who is perfect. The judgment of a God who is holy. And since the standard before us is a perfect one, the outcome of our evaluation is not going to end well for any of us. Unless the outcome of this test is not going to end well for any of us. Unless we have an advocate. Unless we have a mediator, unless we have someone to stand between a holy God and a sinful humanity. Which leads us to one of the primary reasons, one of the main reasons for Jesus' advent. Jesus came to meet the standard on our behalf. Jesus came to reach the bar that we could never reach. Jesus came to this earth 2,000 years ago to write the test. This is an unusual kind of mediation, to be sure. I mean, I've thought it through in terms of another analogy. Imagine a college professor, and you're the students, and the college professor hands out the exams. And at the end of the examination period, he collects all the exams. And he goes through and he marks them. And it turns out that everyone fails the exam. And the students are mortified. And they asked, they said, please give us another chance. Give us a rewrite. But the professor is absolutely certain that a rewrite isn't going to make any difference. The students will continue to fail and fail. So instead, the professor takes a series of blank examination sheets and he fills in the correct answers, the perfect answers for every question. And then the professor announces to the students that they're invited to come and write their name in the top right corner of the page. The page, the examination page, that has all the correct answers. If the student accepts the invitation to assign their name to the professor's work, then they pass the test. Friends, this is not unlike what Jesus has done. It's not unlike what he has offered to us. Contrary to popular opinion, our time on earth is not some prolonged morality test that we hope to somehow pass through our best efforts and our best intentions. The Bible assures us we will not pass the test. Ever. No amount of rewrites will fix this. We cannot pass this test. We cannot meet this standard. Our only hope is if another writes the test for us. And that's what Jesus, in large measure, came to do. His life of perfect obedience to the law is Jesus writing the examination for us. You'll remember that someone else stood in for you at an earlier point in history. You'll remember that Adam and Eve stood in for you, and we know how dreadfully that turned out for humanity. As they stood in for us and failed the test, it introduced disease and sin and suffering and death for the rest of us. This life is not our attempt to get right what Adam got wrong. This life is our opportunity to trust in Jesus, who got right what Adam got wrong. Well, what about Jesus' death, Bryn? That's primary too, isn't it? Well, yes, it is. Our failing the test came with real consequences. A holy God will not turn a blind eye to our sin. He cannot sweep our sin and our mistakes under the carpet, as it were. Every transgression we've ever committed and will commit comes with a real penalty. And if we stay with the academic analogy, every failed exam leads to a detention of sorts. And in real life, the detention means death and separation from God's grace. But in Jesus, we have one who stood in for us in the detention room. Someone who did everything right, got all the correct answers, stood in the detention room for us. In Jesus on the cross, we have one who endured the penalty which should have fallen on us. What did Jesus come to do? What did Jesus come to earth to do? Again, we could offer many answers. But we will be a better help to others, I think, if we can boil it down. If we can give some precision to our answer to this question. Why did Jesus come? What did he come to do? Firstly, Jesus came to write the test that we could not pass. Jesus came to write the test which we could not pass. Secondly, Jesus came to stand in for us and to absorb the penalty which we deserved. And as you think about all that Jesus done, I think you would admit with me that this makes Jesus worthy of all our adoration and all of our praise. Worthy of calling him master and following him every step of the way. I probably don't need to remind this gathering. Christmas is not about what we do in the latter days of December. Christmas is not about the decorations, as nice as they are. Christmas is not about the special meals, as much as I love them. Christmas is not about singing carols. It's not even about being with family. Christmas is the story of the one who is willing to stand in for you. Christmas begins the story of the one who met the standard of God that we could never reach. Accordingly, Christmas is not really about us at all. Christmas is about Him. Now, don't get me wrong, I sincerely hope that you will enjoy your Christmas traditions. I was at a Christmas party last night. It was a delightful time. I took more than my fair share of smoked salmon, and I sang off key to a number of beloved hymns. I enjoy Christmas traditions. And I want you to enjoy your gatherings. I want you to enjoy the people that are surrounding you this Christmas. Enjoy the gifts. Enjoy the turkey or the smoked salmon or whatever it is you're eating this holiday. But more than any of that, remember that Christmas is not about you. And it's not about me. Christmas is about Christ. And so it's not what I want for Christmas or what you want for Christmas, but what Christ deserves. And so above all these other things, I long for you to enjoy Jesus. I long for you to delight in His presence and all that He's done for you and all that He is for you. I long for you to enjoy the presence of Jesus and to do what just about everyone else did 2,000 years ago when He was born. Worship Him. Worship Him. That above all the other things, all the other pressures, worship Jesus Christ, who wrote the test for you and invites you to sign your name. Worship Him who stood in for you and took the punishment. Worship Jesus, who is worthy of our adoration and praise. Amen.